This is the current federal tax developments for the week of December 26, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers. I'm going to take a look this week at some of the developments that took place in federal taxes. And some of those will be this week. We're going to have start out with a case of some injured veterans end up, actually this is law change, now have a chance to claim a refund. The IRS also extended automatic accounting method relief for an issue that was related to the tangible property regulations for an additional year. An organization was denied exempt status because it turned out 50% of the benefits were going to be directly assigned to one pre-selected person. We had an issue where modifications to a trust, the IRS ruled, did not allow for a trust income tax deduction to charity. A partner discovered that taxes like life can be unfair. And a partner who was unable to show debt was allocated to her was found not to have adequate basis on which to claim losses coming to her from the partnership. Well, the date of this particular podcast is the 26th, as that's the Monday for the week in question. And for those of you who may be in Canada, not sure why Canadians are listening to this, but if you are, you know, welcome in. It's well known as Boxing Day in Canada and Great Britain. And this week, we're going to actually, what we're going to do, since this is our last podcast for the week, for basically for the year 2016, this is when we go ahead and box up, shall we say, our 2016 developments and start looking forward to what we're going to have in 2017. And here this week, we do have a few developments that are of a bit of interest, shall we say, as we close out our 2016 cases and start looking at things that are going to start happening to us in 2017. We're going to start out with a final law change that Congress put in. It was signed into law, and that was the Combat Injured Veterans Tax Fairness Act of 2016. This is H.R. 5015, signed into law on December the 16th. Now, this is kind of an interesting problem that deals mainly with some issues with tax withholding by the Department of Defense on certain payments made to veterans that it turns out should not have been considered taxable. What happened in this case, this goes back to the case of St. Clair versus United States, which was an Eastern District of Virginia case from 1991. It does go back a ways. That case found that a lump sum severance payment to a veteran who'd be injured in combat was to be considered excludable from income as payments due for damages as if it was a workers' comp award or was for basically physical injuries, was excludable from income. Unfortunately, Department of Defense continued to report these payments for many years, we're talking about 24 years here, as taxable distributions on the 1099-Rs that they would issue to the veterans, and they would withhold taxes on those payments. Now, clearly, these payments were not truly taxable. So if the veterans filed their return showing it as non-taxable amounts, they would get back those taxes. The problem, of course, was many veterans didn't know about this rule, and they got a 1099-R that showed total amount of taxable distribution to them of X. They had tax withheld on the amount. You might assume that, therefore, assuming the federal government's, you know, withholding taxes, that means the federal government believes that they have a right to tax money on, to basically, to tax these awards. So many of these veterans never basically treated these payments as non-taxable, and so ended up overpaying their taxes for the years in question. Now, as you might guess, going back 24 years, a lot of these years now are closed to refund claims. What the Congress did this year was they passed a bill which effectively is going to open up the statute for these veterans to claim a tax refund. Now, the Department of Defense, within 1 year after this bill was enacted, has to identify the severance payments that it made after January 17, 1991, which is when the St. Clair case came down. The Department computed under Section 1212 of Title 10 of the United States Code. Those were the severance payments in question in this case. The amounts are not considered gross income pursuant to Section 104A4 of the Internal Revenue Code and from which the department withheld taxes. They are supposed to notify the individuals who were covered by that, who had that situation occur, the amount of severance payments that was withheld, and any other information necessary, this term be necessary by the IRS to carry out the purpose of this section, which is to hopefully refund the taxes to those veterans who have paid tax on the amounts they received. And Department of Defense is to give these people instructions for filing amended returns to recover the tax. What Congress did was they've extended the statute for a period of 1 year from the date on which the DOD effectively issues this notice to the veteran to make a claim for refund. So you may want to keep an eye out if you have somebody who you might think fits this category. And again, it goes back 24 years. So we could be talking about some clients who had the situation arise way back. If you have any clients who are impacted by this, you probably should warn them to keep an eye out for this particular little notice. And also to make sure that they get it to you immediately so that you can begin preparing and filing claims for refund. Now, it's not clear yet how quickly Department of Defense will be able to get these notices out, how quickly we're going to be able to get things set up for this, but it is something to keep your eye on for the next few months. Next up in our developments, we have the IRS Notice 2017-6. It was issued on the 20th of December. And what this deals with is a little quirk with the tangible property regulations. Now, as you all remember, back in 2014, we had to adopt the tangible property regulations that were revised by the IRS. And that required a lot of entities to file a 3115 and make for a change of accounting method and change their method of accounting for a whole slew of items related to depreciation, identification of repairs, units of property, and all kinds of other issues. Now, one little problem we've got here is that because there were so many changes that were required, it's very possible that a taxpayer may notice now looking back that they forgot to change the treatment of certain items and get permission for that. This creates a bit of a problem because the IRS knew that might happen. So they suspended a rule, if you were involved with any of these changes related to tangible property regulations, that said you could not get an automatic method change for the current year on an item if you had requested via automatic method changes a change in that item in the prior 5 years. Because in some cases, maybe going back that's in the same area and requesting a change of method to correct something, obviously we need some relief. So the idea was for tax years beginning before January 1st, 2016, they basically waived that. So essentially for 2 years, they waived the issue. So that way taxpayers who had had a change in method under the old regulations weren't suddenly caused a problem, they couldn't go to the new ones. And then those who maybe missed something on their first attempt at the new regulations were able in the following year to come back and request a new change. Unfortunately, the IRS discovered that people were now approaching the IRS having issues that they discovered now in 2016 that related to what they should have done in 14, and they were outside the protective area. That means that the only way these people could change their method would be to apply for to the IRS explicit permission to change the method, which they had to do and get an advance permission. Obviously, that's going to result in the service having a bunch of requests for changes that they probably didn't want to process. And it's going to result in a lot of people having to extend their returns and hope and would have hoped that they would get relief before their returns were due. So because of that, the IRS has now pushed forward this relief from the same change within the change in the same item in the prior 5 year rule will be continue to be suspended for many of the items related to tangible property regulations for an additional year. So now it's going to be for taxable years beginning before January 1st, 2017, allowing you to attach an automatic change request to the 2016 return without worrying about the fact you may have asked for a change in that same item in the past 5 years. That's not going to be a problem for you this year. You can still get your automatic changes. In the printed materials we have available on the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com website, we have all these specific changes that are covered by this. They're the same ones that always have been. But if you want to go look at the details, you've got a client that may have a problem, you can go ahead and take a look at that again on the online version. Next, we have a taxpayer or an organization that was attempting to get a IRS ruling state granting them 501c3 exempt status. Turned out they would not be successful. This is Private Letter Ruling 2016-51016. It was issued on December the 16th. Now, this organization is founded for what sounds like a very good purpose. There was an individual who was diagnosed with cancer, and the organization was formed to attempt to raise money for this person and this person's family, you know, to help them offset the cost of this medical treatment. Now, somebody said, oh, wouldn't it be great? This should be a 501c3 exempt organization. So they went and they essentially tried to and applied for being a C3. There's a problem here. Unfortunately, charities for a specific person generally are not going to be something that's allowed under the Internal Revenue Code. Charities are supposed to be for public benefit, not for the benefit of a specific person. So the IRS obviously quickly came back on this when they went for their relief, or for they went for essentially for the ruling, and quickly point out that we got a problem because you're raising money only for one person and this should be a public benefit. Well, what they did, they came back and they changed their application slightly. And then they said, okay, we are going to identify and pay for other cancer patients in the area that have the same type of cancer as our, you know, the main person we identified. And we're going to pay up to 50% of the funds we receive to those other patients. In fact, we'll reserve 50% to go to people other than the identified individual. The IRS, unfortunately, said that's really still not good enough. You're essentially founded, a significant purpose of your organization is to serve a private interest. If a significant purpose of your organization is to serve the interest of a private individual, the specific person, then it's not going to qualify as an exempt organization, and you're not going to be able to get your 501c3 ruling. And that was why this organization lost its purpose. It's not that this was, you know, raising money improperly in the sense that they were trying to pull a fast one. They were raising for somebody who wasn't deserving. That's not the issue. The problem is you can't really have this private, quote, private charity becomes more of a gift under the Internal Revenue Code, as opposed to charity from a public organization serving the public good as a whole. That is what, for better or worse, Congress has decided to encourage. And that's why, in this particular case, this organization could not gain exempt status. Next up, Chief Counsel Advice 2016-51013. This also came out on December the 16th. Trusts are interesting beasts we've discussed before on claiming a charitable contribution deduction. Generally, to do so, the good news on trust has always been there's no limit percentage of income limitation on a trust for a charitable contribution. The bad news for trusts is that the contribution has to be paid out of gross income, and the contribution has to be one that's authorized by the trust document. In this particular case, the trust in question went to court, and with essentially the consent of all parties involved, they asked for the trust to be modified to effectively allow for payment to be made to the charities, because they wanted this to go to charitable organizations. And so the question came up, the trust has claimed by doing that, saying, well, now the modified trust claims that we can make contributions to charity out of income. We've done so, so we claim a charitable contribution deduction under 642C. When on exam, the IRS suggested that maybe that didn't work, they said, okay, even if we can't get it that way, these charities are beneficiaries of the trust. So if we can't get it through the front door of the charitable contribution deduction of 642C, then we're going to turn around and get it as an income distribution deduction, just like we would to any other beneficiary. Well, this chief counsel advice looked at both of these theories. On the first theory, the chief counsel advice ruled, in the IRS's view, that a state court modification of the trust, even if it's deemed to be retroactive, will not be sufficient to create terms of the trust that allow for a charitable contribution unless the court was interpreting what was a vague provision in the trust already, where there was a dispute, resolving a dispute over a vague provision. Nobody in this case claimed that the trust document as originally written was vague in any way, or, you know, it just didn't allow for this. And nobody claimed that, you know, there was any way to read it to claim that it did allow for it. Rather, they just wanted to modify it to allow it to transfer the funds to charity. Maybe very noble to do so, but it doesn't allow us to change the trust after the fact. Okay, then we don't get a 642C contribution deduction. But hey, these charities are the beneficiaries of the trust. So don't we get an income tax deduction for the income distribution deduction because we're sending them the money out of DNI? Well, unfortunately, that in the IRS's view does not work either. The IRS points out that essentially under regulations governing 642 and 661 of the code, that the 642 provision is the only way to get a deduction for a distribution to a charity. A charity cannot qualify for, in the view of the service, a deduction for an income distribution deduction under Section 661 of the code. Therefore, in this case, the trust gets neither a charitable contribution in the view of the IRS, nor does it get income distribution deduction, so the trust will have to pay taxes on the income for that particular year and then make its distribution to the charity. Not a good result, but the result that the IRS Chief Counsel's Office decided is going to apply in this case. Next, we go up to a pair of cases this week that deal with partnerships. And the first one is the case of Walter S. Mack Jr. versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-229. This case came down on December 19th. Now, this is a case of an attorney, a partner in a law firm. Mr. Mack was a partner in a law firm. The law firm really was operated as two separate partnerships. So there's two related entities. They issue K-1s to Mr. Mack, showing him having total income of $479,473. However, it appears from the facts of the case that Mr. Mack only took distributions of $75,000 from the partnership. Now, he claimed he didn't take any more because under his interpretation of the applicable state law, he had a fiduciary duty, he felt, because his other law firm partners were effectively unable to leave money in the law firm to cover their expenses. So the capital provision of the partnership as a whole was very, very poor. It didn't have any capital. It was kind of in the hole. So Mr. Mack, instead of taking his $479 out, he only took $75,000 out. Now, Mr. Mack thought that under state law, he had to do that because, you know, he had to ensure the creditors all got paid. The IRS, however, told him, you know, basically they're going to follow the K-1. Well, Mr. Mack got his K-1s and he went and talked to the tax preparers and tax advisors of the partnership and outlined his view that in fact, under state law, he had to leave the money in there and that it was obviously wildly unfair for him to pay tax on almost $480,000 when he was only going to be able to take $75,000 out. And everybody nodded and says, you know what? That's horribly unfair. We totally understand your concern, but it's still the tax law. According to the tax law, that's your allocable share of income, which Mr. Mack did not dispute that that was his share of income for the partnership agreement. And unfortunately, whether that's distributed to you or not, you're going to have to pick that up as income. Well, Mr. Mack decided that he just wasn't going to report that, you know, he was only going to report what he actually could receive, and he would then accept the consequences. Well, obviously, one of the consequences was that the IRS discovered his reporting difference. The IRS came after him for the tax to be paid, and the IRS also decided he should be subject to penalties. Now, Mr. Mack, of course, took this to the tax court, and unfortunately for Mr. Mack, the tax court took the same position as the service. Whether he likes it or not, unfair or not, he's got to pay tax on his flow-through income. The advice he had received from the tax preparers and the tax advisors for the partnership was totally correct. As well, because he had effectively ignored that advice, the court said that there was no good faith reason that he couldn't get a good faith exception to the 20% accuracy related penalty. He was clearly over $5,000 or 10% of the tax it should have been due on the return was what he was off for his shortfall in taxes. So he's automatically subject to the negligence penalty. His position did not have substantial authority. It was not a disclosed position with a reasonable basis. And therefore, his only real way to get out of this would have been to have claimed that he made a good faith attempt to estimate his proper tax, and he acted in good faith, and he had a reasonable basis for the position for doing what he did. And the court found he had neither. He had no basis because he had been informed this is how the law works, whether you like it or not. And number two, he didn't act in good faith because he ignored the advice of people who were knowledgeable and, you know, knew the law. And he just didn't like the result. And not liking the result is unfortunately not good enough. Neither is arguing that the law is unfair. Good enough reason not to pay the tax. Next up, let's take a look at the case of Hargis versus Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 232, issued on December the 21st. Now, this case actually involved a husband and wife. The husband owned S Corp, basically shares for a number of S Corps, and the wife owned interests in LLCs, taxes, partnerships. Now, the S Corp part of the case, which is actually the longer part if you read it, is the standard kind of problem we run into. Mr. Hargis had guaranteed debts, or he was co-obligors on debts, but, you know, as the court points out, you can't get basis for that in an S Corp. So that was pretty straightforward. He didn't have any basis. But the more interesting side was the attack on Brenda Hargis. Brenda was a partner in a partnership. These are LLCs, taxes, partnerships. They basically were real estate partnerships that owned buildings. They were buildings that were actually being leased to the S corporations that Mr. Hargis was operating. And they had large, as you might guess, traditional real estate. We had large debts outstanding to banks that were used to buy the buildings. Now, Brenda had losses flowing through from these partnerships. Brenda argued that she should be able to deduct those losses because she was on the hook for all the loans. She was on the hook because in one partnership's case, she had guaranteed the partnership's debt. In the other case, she was one of the co-obligors on the note. So she argued, look, the bank come after me for the whole balance of the loan. And because of that, I should be able to deduct all of the losses that the partnership incurs because I clearly would have a liable basis. The IRS and the court said, sorry, Brenda, we can't follow that. First thing, which is important to understand, is the mere fact that the bank could come after Brenda for the debt is not really sufficient to allow that fully to be basis. The question is not whether they could come after for the debt, but does Brenda have any right of reimbursement? Generally, we're going to assume these debts under the partnership debt rules probably were going to be considered recourse, although that's not totally clear. It's most likely, per the guarantees and per the co-obligor status, that these were probably recourse debt, even if they didn't directly say they were coming after the partners for this. In a case of recourse debt, to allocate that debt to the partners, you have to go through the rules found in Regulation 1.752-2, and you have to go through how we're going to allocate that debt. The first thing we have to do is go through a constructive liquidation of the partnership. That's where we assume that we have to pay all the liabilities immediately of the partnership. And except for debt that secures the liability that's non-recourse, we have to assume that all the partnership's assets have a value of zero. We dispose of the property at that zero, trigger our losses. We allocate those losses to the partners based on the partner's partnership agreement. We look at the capital accounts. We figure out who would have to contribute cash per the partnership agreement to make everything whole. And bottom line is, we then figure those people that are having to contribute the cash to pay off the debt are the individuals who are going to be allocated that part of the debt. Brenda showed no documentation of how this calculation would work for her. You know, the court pointed out, merely being liable on the debt's not sufficient. Brenda had to show her allocation. And it didn't help that all the K-1s she received left the liability section of the K-1 blank, giving at least theoretically a belief that for whatever reason, Brenda had no debt allocated to her. Now that was true, even though one of the members of the partnership testified, oh, no, we meant to divide it up evenly among all of our people according to their partnership interest. Well, that testimony is not good enough either, because we need to take a look at the partnership agreement and figure out how this would be allocated, and legally under state law and the agreement or any other documents that may be in play and that are enforceable, who would end up having to write the check? Because Brenda never made that analysis, the court was okay with the IRS position that she failed to show she had any basis. So her basis was zero and her allowed deductions were none for the current year. Well, this is, as I mentioned earlier, our final podcast for 2016. Want to remind you all that we have now the new year 2017 coming up. So hopefully you all have a happy new year coming up. You'll enjoy, you know, your festivities there for the year. Want to remind you all to don't forget to consider your state society CPE in 2017. We'll have, you know, some states that are involved in this podcast, you know, have programs that are running in January. So you might take a look at those. A lot of states run programs on tax staff training and similar backgrounds here in January. You'll also see a lot of accounting and auditing courses that will also come up as we get into the tax season. So if you've got members of your firm need that, obviously they're going to be looking in that area as well. And we just have a few, you know, closeout courses that'll be there here in January. So if you have any of those, you know, look at your state society. I will be doing a pair of them, as I mentioned earlier, here in Phoenix this month for the month of January in that regard. So I have two more left to do for state societies. So be sure to check that out. And as we go forward, keep your eyes open. Also, during tax season, most state societies will still offer webcasts and webinars of various sorts. So maybe you can't get off to a full day CPE during tax season, but you might keep an eye out. A lot of them be offering 1 or 2 hour courses, or they via their partners will be offering 1 or 2 hour courses. So you might look at setting in some of those too, especially if you have a specific problem that you're running into. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December 26, 2016. Be sure to catch our updates during the week at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com on the web. You can also download a PDF with articles describing all the items we talked about this week. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. It'll be at edzollers is a tag to follow me there on Twitter. Hopefully you have a good, fun remainder of 2016 for what's left, and you enjoy your new year. You know, welcome in 2017, and we'll join you back here next week. We'll give you the beginning of 2017, our first 2017 edition of the podcast. We'll talk about current federal tax developments coming into the new year.